All right, today on the Tea Podcast, we have a special guest. They're all special in their own way, but this one's really cool because he is a local entrepreneur, a local developer, an investor of businesses, a former professional baseball player, and he's also been inducted into the Louisiana Athletic Hall of Fame. It's Phil Devey, so we're going to be talking with him about all that, how he got here to Louisiana, because he's not originally from here. So that'll be really cool. So stick around and enjoy the show. All right, so get the split screen set up and we're good. So let me go ahead and tell you about our presenting sponsor real quick, and then we'll get the show on the roll here. Our presenting sponsor is Chase Group Construction. They take the lead and become your one point of contact for the entire design build process. So if you're looking to build a business, whether it be from the ground up or to renovate a space, check them out. They're local. They have a great diverse portfolio of projects from medical centers to popular restaurants and multi-unit shopping centers. ChaseGroupConstruction.com. Check them out. And let's get on with the show. So, Phil Devey, welcome to the Tea Podcast.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, man. Thanks for coming on. So, I am excited to have you on because, let me just be honest, you and I, we've done stuff together for a while as far as, like, business exchanges of information and me reaching out to like, hey, what's going on here? What do you know about this? What's your involvement? And also you've used us to promote some of your listings and some of your projects. But what I did not know, and shame on me, is whenever I booked you, I did not realize that you were a former professional baseball player.
Well, you can't tell from looking at me, so I understand why that wasn't the first thought that came to your head.
I don't know what I expected to see, but whenever I Googled you, because I was like, let me just see if there's anything on him, like his website or anything like that. Obviously, I knew your website, Frontline Real Estate Group, but I wasn't expecting to see a Wikipedia. That was interesting. So I want to know, tell me about you. Tell me, obviously, you're from, originally from Quebec, Canada. I think that's how you say it. Tell me about you. Like, you're from Canada. How did you get to Louisiana? I have some notes. Obviously, I know a little bit, but I'd like to, you know, get our conversation started with that.
All right. So it's, and just by coincidence, the person that got me here is back here. My mom flew in a couple days ago, so she was instrumental in getting me to Louisiana at the time. You know, I grew up playing hockey in Quebec, small town, Lachute, mostly Francophone city. Grew up speaking French and English. My dad's English, my mom's French, so we spoke French and English at the dinner table, just depending on who you're talking to. But I love baseball. I played, you know, as a kid. 15, 16 years old, figured out I felt like I was good at it. I had a chance to play against Team USA. I was playing for Team Quebec. At the time, the Team USA roster was loaded with guys that became major league stars but guys that had gotten drafted, offered all kinds of money. And I'm like, my God, like I'm, you know, pitching against them. And, we ended up losing, but we lost 1-0. And the one run was a home run by a guy named Rick Ankiel, who went on to be a really good Major League Baseball player. And he pitched against us and just shoved it against us. But leaving there, I was like, man, I think I can compete against these guys. But, you know, there's no exposure to colleges and all that kind of thing. So my mom came here for a French teachers conference. And
was she a teacher?
So both my parents were teachers for a long time, 40 years plus. You know, both now retired, but... but my mom in particular was a French teacher at the high school that I went to, and she came here for a teacher's conference. At the time, I'd graduated high school. You know, she knew I wanted to play college baseball. That's really what I wanted to compete against American baseball players. I wanted to see, like, can I do it? But, you know, had no connections or whatnot. So when my mom came, she made it a point to go to the baseball field. She met a lady that she became friends with the conference, told the lady about me, wanted to play baseball.
And the conference was in Lafayette?
In Lafayette. Okay. That lady happened to be Crowley, from Crowley. And she said, oh, I know the baseball coach there is from Crowley to Tony Robichaux. Let me go drop you off over there and see if you can go talk to him. So she just showed up at the field. My mom's, you know, 5 foot two, heavy, you know, French accent, walked in and said, oh, my son's a pitcher and wants to play in college. And, you know, he probably thought this is, you know, not going anywhere. But he gave her his business card. And when she came home, she gave me his business card. And I just called him every day for 2 weeks. Like, I mean, racked up about a bunch of long distance phone calls. And I just kept him on the phone, asking him gazillion questions about everything, about pitching. He'd tell me about the Ice Gators. We talked about country music, Cajun culture, whatever. Finally, he was just tired of hearing from me. And he's like, look, if you can find your way down here, you know, we'll have tryouts on this date. And so that's basically how it happened. I got some air miles or a plane ticket from my uncle who travels a lot. He flew me down. I brought my hockey equipment in case I didn't make the baseball team.
Yeah.
And so I just showed up, got picked up at the airport. It was in August. I remember walking through the airport doors to the outside, feeling like I got punched in the mouth. The humidity was just horrific. And it was, you know, hot. And, but I didn't know anything about Louisiana. All I knew is they sent me a media guide with the roster from the year before, and I'm looking at players that are, you know, 6'4", 6'5", and here I am, like 5'11", 160 pounds, thinking, okay, this is nuts. But I'm friends with the guys I played with at the time, but they all like to tell the story that when they first met me, they all thought I was a trainer or like the equipment manager.
Yeah.
And anyway.
Because you're a small guy?
Yeah. Just, you know, I was small, had, you know, wore glasses. I was nerdy then, I'm nerdy now, but, you know, it was, but ended up making the team my background and how I got here is just crazy to me. It's like, I look at it like I'm a third party, not participant. Like it's crazy that this is my story and all these things kind of develop. But my first college win as a freshman, they brought me in with the bases loaded at LSU, tie ball game, fifth inning, and facing two All-Americans, two legends at LSU, Eddie Furness and Brandon Larson. And I was just dumb enough to not know who they were. So,
yeah.
But, you know, around 10,000 people, you know, the fans screaming against me and everything, and pitched really well and got the win. And then things started picking up from there as far as like my baseball career. But it was just a lot of fun. I mean, my intro to Louisiana or Lafayette was the guys taking me to go see Two Live Crew at the Plaza. And so that's how I got introduced to Lafayette. And I was like, oh boy, this is a crazy place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. Go back a little bit to Canada. You mentioned that you wanted to see if you could compete with American baseball players or American sports players. What made you think what made you even question if you could even compete? Like, is sports different in Canada versus America in that sense? Like,
yeah, I mean, the guys I was competing against were all, you know, from Quebec and other players. And it took me a while to get to play in the like top league in Quebec, but then I had success there in that league. So, you know, for me, I've kind of figured out about myself. I never want to live with regret. So the question of like, you know, what if, or if I could have done something, I don't know if I have an inherent fear of being in my 80s and looking back at my life saying, man, I wish I would have done these things.
Yeah.
So
I think everybody who strives to be something probably has that fear.
Yeah. So, and maybe mine was, I don't know, stronger than most, or, but you know, that's part of what compelled me to say, you know, I need to see if I can. And I wasn't scared to fail. it was, I think it was more the fear of not trying. And so I had to find a way to put myself in a position to figure out, can I compete at that level?
Okay. So in school in Canada, baseball was the only thing, or sports was the only thing in your interest at that time. Like, because right now you do a lot with business and developing and your real estate. Like, was that even a thought process for you as a kid?
No, I don't think so. And I've thought about that, but I mean, hockey was the primary sport, and we didn't have baseball in high school, but we'd play like in the summer league. Just the weather-wise, you know, you can't play baseball in February, March, and whatnot. But I never really had a keen interest in real estate. But I do remember as a kid, whether we're driving into Montreal or whatnot, and seeing these strip centers, or and having a thought in my head like, I'd have a lot more interest in owning the real estate than owning those businesses. Like, somebody is owning the buildings. Never really went much further than that, but I do remember that being kind of a thought in the back of my head. But the transition from baseball to the business world was really just, I had to figure out what I was going to do with the next stage of my life.
Yeah. Cause you can't play baseball forever.
Yeah, no, at some point, someone forces you to take the jersey off.
Yeah.
And you fight it for as long as you can until it's inevitable and your career is done. And for some people it happens in middle school, some people in high school, some people in college. You know, I was just fortunate that I was able to keep the jersey on longer than most.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you started off as a walk-on pitcher for UL Lafayette. And so I have right here, you were also, you earned the Cape Cod Baseball League's Outstanding Pitcher Award in 1998. Is that true?
I'm just testing your research skills. So, yes, that is true. So, good job. That is a fact. That was great. That was a summer league. In fact, I think there's a movie that was based around the Cape Cod League. I don't remember the name of it, but... I got to play with a bunch of great players, against a bunch of great players, a bunch of guys that went on to play in the major leagues. The team I was on, our three main starters were myself, a guy named Ben Sheets, who was a Major League Baseball All-Star, and then Barry Zito, who also, I think, actually won a Cy Young. I think he did, but I know he was a Major League All-Star also. And I ended up being the pitcher of the year that year in the Cape.
Nice.
Which I guess, honestly, further grew my confidence of, I can really compete. It was a great experience. So everything that was offered to me through baseball were just amazing experiences that I would never have thought for a kid, for me from Lachute, Quebec, to have the opportunity to travel the country, even travel the world. I mean, I've played with the Canadian national team. And in 2004, I got to play in the Olympics. So like, no way as a kid did I ever think that was humanly possible.
Yeah.
And it really was just from starting things off with, I need to see if I needed to challenge myself. It was really what it was like. Okay, I've done well in this area. I need to challenge myself and grow, and let me go to the next level, and then the next level, and then the next level. And, you know, for me, I never made it to the major leagues. And just the circumstances never worked out. It didn't work out for me to get to the major leagues. But, you know, I got real close as far as playing in AAA. But I have no regret over any of it. Like, I sincerely feel like I gave it everything I could to get to that level, and it didn't work out, but that's okay. Like, it's built a lot of things in me, and it's given me all that I could ever want or ask in terms of the experiences, the friendships, the learning, the experiences, the things that I'm taking with me to the grave and even beyond, because it's things that I'm infiltrating to my own kids and my own circle. So, Yeah, it's only because I tried. You know, it's really only because I tried and I pushed myself.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you never played for the major leagues. So I guess I have a genuine question now. I'm a little confused. So you were drafted into the Los Angeles Dodgers back in 1999, from what it looks like. And is that not a major league team?
Yeah. So when you get drafted, you're drafted by a major league team. Let's say it's like you're playing junior varsity and the major league team is a varsity team. When you get a paycheck, it's coming from the major league team.
Okay.
So you have, which is the minor league. So it's called the minor leagues. Like you have different divisions in the minor leagues. So man, I'm really schooling you now.
Yeah, holy cow. All right. A lot.
So you have like a A ball rookie league, A ball league, double A league, triple A league, and then the major leagues. So let's say you're Alex Rodriguez and you're a shortstop with the New York Yankees. Well, he's not the shortstop, Derek Jeter. So you're Derek Jeter, you're a shortstop for the Yankees. Well, under you, there's, let's say, five other shortstops that are fighting for your position.
Okay.
Outside of, you know, trading for other teams and all that kind of thing, but you got a shortstop in rookie ball, you got one in A ball, you got one in double A, you got one in triple A. So those guys are all fighting for your job. And the rookie ball guy is fighting for the A-ball guy's job. And the A-ball guy's job is fighting for the double A. So
there's a food chain.
Yes, there's a food chain. And these, so there's a team in New Orleans that's a triple A major league affiliated team. There's a double A team in Mobile, Alabama. There's a double A team in Pensacola, Florida. There's minor league teams all over the country with great baseball that compete.
Yeah.
And everybody's goal is to get to the major leagues. But just to get to the minor leagues, it's less than 1% of a high school baseball player that gets to at least to that level. And then from there, from rookie ball to get to playing A ball, then double A, then triple A.
So it's a lot harder to get to the major leagues than I thought.
Oh, yeah.
Just thought, you know, you play college baseball and then you get drafted into this team. And I knew that there were tiers of players. So, like, one player is, like, the essentially the bench warmer, somebody who's, like, a fill-in just in case one of the other players gets – or, like, the main player gets injured or something, and so this guy fills in. Same thing with football, you know. And I don't – look, I'm not the hardest – sports guy.
We're learning right here. This is good.
Yeah. So my kid's in baseball right now. He loves baseball. He's been playing since Wii Ball, and he's now in coach's pitch. I just so happen to be the assistant coach.
Oh, God.
And the coach that the main coach decided that I should be the pitcher.
Right.
So I'm over here like, oh, God, I've never been a pitcher in my life as far as like any kind of, you know, audience-based game.
Yeah.
Like, of course, you know, friends play, I'll pitch, whatever. I felt like there were times where I could throw, but, like, I was never classified as a pitcher. But now I'm the coach's pitcher, which I'm so nervous with. But I've always understood that there were, like, some tiers, but I didn't realize just how many tiers from, obviously, rookie to that. I guess I never paid that close attention to labels. I just figured that if they're on TV, they're in the major leagues.
Yeah.
That's my perception, yeah. You know?
Usually, there's times where someone might introduce me or say, hey, you know, he played in the major leagues. So I usually will correct them, like, I didn't play in the major leagues, but I played in the minor leagues, and I played for 7 years. So,
yeah.
Have you ever seen the movie Bull Durham?
No.
All right, well then, there's your homework assignment.
Okay.
Watch Bull Durham. I can probably name a few other that are like baseball movies related to life in the minor leagues.
Okay.
But, you know, it's a long bus rides and you know, you're in random towns and all across the country. You know, I mean, it's great. But after 7 years, it starts to get long. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Honestly, For me, I love playing in college because I love the man that I played for, and I love my teammates, and that drove me to, like, be better. That made me feel like I was King Kong on the mound because I had all this support around me. And, you know, in the minor leagues, you're really competing against your own teammates because everybody's fighting for that job.
Yeah, that feels so weird.
Yeah, and so, and it was great for the first 3-4 years, but then it just started getting a little, just mentally it was tough. My enjoyment of the game was just kind of waning over the years. And it started feeling a little bit more like a profession. There was less satisfaction out of it. So I knew my time was coming just in my own mind of like, man, do I want to keep doing this? Like if I'm not enjoying it as much, you know, what am I doing it
for?
So yeah, my attention just started turning into, you know, okay, what else do I want to do with my life at this point? You know, 'cause this isn't really doing it for me anymore. So
yeah, that's crazy, man. We got a comment that came through, actually, somebody who I just had on the podcast last week, the Cajun Critic, he says, I tried to play baseball once. I got hit once and said, nah, I'm good. Look, I don't blame you for that. I played, I don't know what you call it, I guess Little League, like the small town baseball teams, kind of recreational baseball when I was littler, like probably 13, 14-ish. And we were the White Sox. That's not relevant to the story, but we just were. I thought it was cool that I had the black uniform with the knockoff White Sox logo in the hat. You know, technically that's all copyright infringement, but, you know, people don't say anything typically to recreational leagues like that. But, yeah, I remember getting hit several times. And not because I couldn't catch, but because the way the field was positioned – the sun was in the right spot of the sky where the ball was a pop fly, and I could not see this ball to save my life, and my eyes are super sensitive to the brightness of the sky. Yeah. It could be a cloudy day, and if there's certain brightness, I have to wear my sunglasses. I have sunglasses almost all the time. And, yeah, it just whacked me right in the face. I said, I don't know. I don't know if this is meant for me.
I think growing up playing hockey probably prepared me for whatever injuries would come up with baseball.
Oh, God, I'm sure.
No, I've had some... I've had some injuries in baseball, which may not be worth the discussions, but I guess the message for the kids would be when you're pitching, think about wearing a jock strap, because I didn't, and I've been crushed a couple times where I had to go to the hospital, and it was not fun.
My wife told me that I might need to get a jock strap, and I'm like, there I don't know. It's just a kid's thing, but some of these kids can hit.
Dude, trust me. I didn't learn my lesson after the second time, but I did when it was number three. So
okay. Well, now I might look into it.
Yeah.
Well, I got to get my sponsor in real quick, and then we'll continue the conversation with Phil Devey with all his other career moves and kind of working towards where he's at today and what he's doing in Lafayette and why he's still in Lafayette. You know. Okay. So. Go ahead and get my sponsor mentioned here. It is the Music Academy of Acadiana. You've heard me talk about them before, and if you're new to the podcast, welcome to the show, and welcome to the sponsor that you are hearing for the first time. So they can help you unleash your musical potential. They are a locally founded company founded by UL Lafayette Music School graduate Tim Benson. Man, UL Lafayette runs strong in this town hard. Obviously, it's our hometown university. But yeah, so they teach anything from piano, guitar, drums, violin, saxophone, flute. They can help you improve your voice. They can help you help you learn audio production. So if you're looking to build a career maybe in that, you can really make that work out. They have tons of instructors, lots of students, like over 500 students in and out each month. So it's a really well-known school, tons of accolades. I won't bore you with all of that, but it's a really great company. Like I said, locally founded. The founder is actually in a local emo, screamo cover band called The Criers. So look up The Criers on Facebook or however you want to find them out. They're really cool. So it's good to see that the founder's using his school also as a way to promote the cover band, which they sound exactly like all the music you remember from the early 2000s. So if you're in that vein of music, check them out. But their website is musicacademyacadiana.com. Check them out. You can Google them. Great school. Nothing bad to say about them. So, yeah, and they're sponsors. So I can't say anything bad about them. Why would I? But anyway, yeah, check them out. We appreciate our sponsors. All right. And so I had a couple more comments come through. Somebody, the Cajun critic said, if I tried to swing a bat now, I'd probably throw my back out. Yeah, I'm with you on that one. So continuing with your careers here. So some of the other things, okay, your professional career, of course, included Los Angeles Dodgers. You also played at AA affiliates like the Seattle, I think Mariners is how you pronounce it. Is that right?
Yep.
Very yeah. Good. Okay. Because it looks like it could be Mariners, you know, but Boston Red Sox and Philadelphia Phillies. And also you had, of course, your international career. You mentioned the Olympics earlier. So you played Team Canada. Team Canada. They're close. Yeah. Team Canada in 2004 in the Summer Olympics. I want to learn a little bit more about the Summer Olympics things. You came to Louisiana, I guess in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s. You were going to school here. Did you finish school here? And why are you playing on Team Canada in 2004 on the Summer Olympics? What's that timeline look like?
So yes, I graduated in 99, so I was actually a junior when I graduated.
Okay.
So I was I could have stayed for the 2000 season as my senior year, but I left as a junior, which, you know, I'd say to regret. I mean, things work out the way they do, but I left in 99, 2000 would have been my senior year, and the baseball team went to Omaha, went to the College World Series in 2000.
So yeah, good.
I like to say they needed me to leave in order to make it to the World Series. But in the Olympics in baseball, you're allowed to use professional players in the Olympics. But they can't be on the active major league roster to play. So that didn't exist before then, but that rule had changed. I don't know, at some point, maybe in the year 2000 it would have been before 2004. So when the Olympics came around, you know, whether it's USA or Canada or Mexico, whoever, they have to get permission from the major league organization to allow the player to leave for 2 weeks or 3 weeks to play in the Olympics. And so I was with the Mariners at the time. Team Canada reached out to the Mariners asking if I could play. So they granted permission. And when I found out I was going to be playing on the Olympic team was the day before my flight to go to the opening ceremonies.
Wow.
So I'd actually was replacing a player named Jeff Francis, who got called up to the big leagues with the Rockies. And so then that opened up a spot for a pitcher. And so they reached out to the Mariners and then, you know, called me and said, hey, the Mariners gave permission. Would you like to play in the Olympics? And my phone was already down. I was packing my stuff and they flew me the day before the opening ceremonies. So like the very next day after, you know, 2 days after that phone call, I'm literally walking in to in Athens, Greece, with the whole Canada contingent, you know, walking in the whole opening ceremonies, the torch lighting, you know, I got hanging out with, you know, I got a picture with me with Tim Duncan, which I don't, you probably don't know who that is. He's a, you know, very famous NBA player with the Olympic torch in the background. And I mean, I met all kinds of unbelievable athletes and I'm like, what is going on here? I mean, it was crazy. Greatest sports experience I've ever had for sure. We lived in an Olympic village that was built specific for the Olympics where all the athletes lived. Like we had this giant cafeteria, this swimming pool, this track and field place. I remember like, I was jogging on the track and, you know, a bunch of other athletes kind of, you know, warming up and all that. And there was like four or five women with the Russian track team. I don't know what discipline they were. And they were running as well. And I'm jogging like at a pretty good clip and they're just flying right past me, like as if they're only in like the fifth of 10 gears. And so I kind of try to speed up just to see if I can catch up. And I mean, they lapped me probably three times.
Dude.
We'd be at the pool. We're watching swimmers swimming and, like, you know, kind of training or practicing. We're just hanging out, you know, BSing with each other and joking around. And but, like, the sound that they were making, hitting, like, their arms and legs kicking in the pool, they were like machines. I'd be in the gym working out, and I'm watching, like, people on the treadmill on levels that I didn't even know existed. And, like, like these girls that were half my size lifting weights, like, bigger than I can lift. I mean, and I'm sitting here saying, Why are you even there? I'm embarrassed to say I'm an Olympic athlete because, like, I don't deserve that title. Like, look at these people around me. It was unreal.
Yeah.
But we had such a great time, and we competed really well. We ended up in fourth place, which sucks because that's probably the worst place you can finish in the Olympics, because that means
you
missed out on the bronze medal.
Right. You don't even get on the pedestal at all.
Yeah. But man, it was so much fun and just amazing experience to be around all that. And the difference between us and a lot of the other disciplines were, like, they, you know, they're working really hard to compete in this one event, and we're competing at a high level every day. I mean, there's hardly a day off. So we were used to that environment. And I mean, like, I'll say we were partying pretty hard, but, like, we were partying pretty hard, right in the Olympic Village in competition, because that's just what we did.
Yeah.
And as other Olympic athletes started to, like, where their discipline was over with, or let's say they didn't place, and athletes from all different countries just started gravitating towards, like, where we were staying, just, like, to hang out with us and party with us too and stuff. So, I mean, it was awesome.
Yeah, man, that sounds like an experience. I'll never be a part of the Olympics. there's no writing about business Olympic team. There's no podcaster Olympics. I would have said
the same thing. Trust me, you never know.
But, like, so how? I guess I'm curious. Typically, does a person know that they're going to be going to the Olympics pretty early? It seems like you found out, like,
I found out because I was a replacement. I was a replacement for someone else. Yeah. Okay. And what was pretty cool was we had a game against Team Australia where we needed to win in order to get into the medal rounds. And I don't know why the circumstances were that I started the game. So I was pitched. So they asked me to start to pitch that game. And it was a pretty important game. And it was on a Sunday, and it was aired nationally in Canada. And I mean, I had a circle of friends or people that barely even knew that I played baseball.
Yeah.
To begin with. Like, I left Canada to go to the US and thought I was going to school, and all of a sudden I've got a professional career, and now here I am. So everybody was watching the game. And I mean, you know, I'm sure my parents were watching, my, you know, family members. So everybody's nervous. I'm nervous. And I had a great game and ended up getting the win. So we won, like, I mean, won by a lot. I forget what the score was, but I mean, we played an amazing game. But, you know, I still have the ball at my house of the win from the Olympics. So I got a phone call 2 days before the Olympics. Everybody else on the roster had already known because they made the team and all that. And there's a lot of, like, you know, funny stories from all that. But I think I was the only one on the team that was drug tested during the Olympics, which was hilarious because they were all on the bus after a practice in Athens, and an official gets on the bus and with, like, a clipboard and saying, hey, we need a drug test. He says my name, and everybody's, like, looking at me, and everybody starts laughing because the last person that should look suspicious, like he's on steroids, is me.
Right, right.
And so I'm the one that happens to get drug tested. But
do you know why they might have?
It was just a random, random drug test. It was me, probably the smallest guy on the team.
Interesting. Okay, something about that seems puzzling.
Maybe. No conspiracy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There,
but not trying to start a conspiracy, but hey.
I just thought it was pretty funny. It was Team USA set us up. How about that?
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, so we talked a good bit about your sports career. I want to know, obviously, you can't play baseball your entire life professionally. Obviously, you could play recreationally, I'm sure. Do you do that at all? Do you play recreationally?
No. Nothing? I mean, my two boys play baseball, so I, coach them.
Yeah.
I have one that's 16 that's still playing.
Well, yeah, I think that's fair. You're involved
with
it. Yeah.
I'm throwing batting practice. I'm still involved. Yeah.
So at what point, when did your baseball career kind of taper off, and when did you have to get serious about your future, and what did that look like for you? Because, like you said, baseball wouldn't last forever. You had to transition. Tell me a lot about that. Talk me through that time of your life.
Yeah, so 2005. So, the Olympics were in 2004. Then in 2005, I got signed on with the Red Sox, and I was in Double A with the Red Sox. But that's when it kind of hit me, like the playing on Team Canada and the experience of playing for your team and your country and how much I enjoyed that. And I kind of figured out that I love playing baseball because I love the sport, but I love competing for my teammates. Like, we're going to battle together, and that really brought the best out of me. And then going back to the minor leagues, and, then it becomes kind of competing against your own teammates. So, you're fighting for that same job in the major leagues. And anyway, so I started reading some books on different topics, business related, to just start thinking about the next. So I read a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad, Robert Kiyosaki. That really changed my thought process of like real estate, what I might be interested in. It was kind of a mind shift moment about investing, money, business. And then it geared me into real estate. So then I started reading some more books about real estate specifically. Then it got me reading about books about distressed properties and foreclosures and those kind of things. So then really in 2005, by then my baseball career was done. I had no money. I mean, minor leagues, you're barely getting paid.
Have you had any money from baseball?
No. So I got married in 2004. So now I'm unemployed. I was doing some baseball lessons with kids and stuff. So that was paying the bills. But I need to get into a career.
Yeah.
So started learning about foreclosures. Then I started tracking pre-foreclosures in Lafayette. At the time they'd come out in the newspaper 30 days before the sheriff's sale. I was looking at all the addresses. I started going to look at the properties. I don't know anything about construction. I didn't know anything about how to do anything. I'd never grew up in that environment. Like, I couldn't change the tire of my own car. I probably still can't. But real estate really intrigued me. So then I'd go to the sheriff's sale as if I had money. And I'd watch the process. And then I wanted to see, like, okay, what people are paying for these properties. Is it in line with what I was thinking? And then I started to go look at the property after somebody bought it, just see what they were doing with it. And I started figuring out, like, okay, I'm kind of on the same wavelength of how these guys are doing things. But then I started thinking, there's got to be a better way than to just go to sheriff's sale and auction for a house. There's got to be a way to buy them before it gets to that point. So I started knocking on people's doors that were going to be going to sheriff's sale.
All right.
And at the time I was.
Is that legal to do?
The same way I can walk up to your door and knock on the door and say, hi, my name's Phil. I'm a real estate investor. I mean, I made it sound like I knew what I was doing. At least I think
right,
I did.
Right.
But I just always thought there's. It's got to be better for someone to sell their house than just lose it to foreclosure, especially if they have some equity in it. So I ended up getting a deal doing that, knocking on doors and that kind of thing. But now I needed a way to pay for it, and I had no money. I mean, literally.
Yeah,
like,
so how'd
my financial
that?
Statement was a zero. So I had a friend of mine, Randy Olson, who's a title attorney, prime title. I met him through baseball and working with the kids. And I told him, I want to get in real estate. I got this deal. But he gave me a list of some banks to maybe go talk to, and one in particular was Rain State Bank. A friend of his, Wayne Barres, who happened to be also had played at UL or USL as a pitcher. He's like, hey, why don't you start with him and go talk to him? So I met with Wayne. This was in 2005, and the deal I had, there was plenty of equity. There was enough money in it for me to figure out how to do renovations and that kind of thing. So he agreed to finance it because, the bank was in good position. And that was my first one. And it managed to work out. I don't know how, because again, through the renovations of it, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But I'm hiring people to do different things, and I have no idea whether they're doing it right or doing it wrong, but I'm figuring it out. I'm trying to learn from other people. In the meantime, I'm still educating myself, learning. And then, that one deal worked out, and here comes another deal. Okay, boom, boom, boom. Over the course of 4 years or so, then I started doing short sales. And I don't know if you're familiar with a short sale. It's like you're negotiating with the bank to take less than what's owed. And before, it wasn't a term, but I knew. So if the person didn't have equity, it's got to be better for the homeowner and for the bank to be able to sell it now than let it go to foreclosure. Then the bank stuck with it as an asset on their, as a liability on their books. And so it started figuring out how to negotiate with the bank to take less than what's owed, but allow the debtor, the owner, to be able to be dismissed of the debt or the deficiency balance, and kind of figure the traps of that and worked all that out. And, after 4 years or so of doing that, I thought or felt like there was probably not a distressed property in Lafayette Parish that I did not know about. If it made it to sheriff's sale, it's because I've already passed it up for whatever reason. Like, I knew everything about it. Wow. I knew the owner. I knew how much they owed. I knew what it was worth. I learned ways to gather all this information, learning things through the courthouse process and different things, learning how to find people, an abandoned house. I mean, I've found people from, I could tell stories for days of like the different deals that were done. I mean, I had a deal where I had to put a deal together, and then I go to the house, and there's cops canvassing the neighborhood looking for the guy that I was buying the property from because he was out for attempted manslaughter.
Wow.
I bought a house from a lady that when we were going to go to closing, Randy Olson, the title attorney, calls me to say, man, come to find out she was married at the time. You're going to need the husband's signature. Well, I got to find out about the husband. The husband's in jail for trying to hire a hitman to kill his wife.
Awesome.
So then I find out the guy's in a federal pen in Bro Bridge. So I said, well, this is a good deal. I'm going to go see if I can talk to him. Go to the federal pen in Bro Bridge.
You went to the prison.
Oh, yeah. They locked me in a room by myself, a room just like this, with just me and him. They walk him in. He was this giant German guy with tattoos, and they sit him at a table, and then the warden leaves and leaves me there by myself with him.
No, you're about to...
Yeah, dude, yeah.
No.
And I managed to put a deal together with him.
With the convict.
Where he started off saying, I'm never going to help her out, yada, yada. And then 2 years later, I'm building a house in that same neighborhood, and the roofer tells me that he's worked on a house in that area before, and come to find out, it was the house that I had bought, and he said that, yeah, the husband tried to hire me to kill his wife. I'm like, what?
Dude.
So he was the one that turned him into the police. And anyway, so
wow.
Yeah. So I got these crazy experiences of like tracking down deals and doing all this stuff. So from that, I needed the income from flipping houses to pay bills and all that kind of thing. But then after having done that for 4 or 5 years, it was, knowing, okay, like if I have opportunities to start thinking longer term and, really building wealth and a nest egg and, starting to collect money, rental income and
residual.
Correct. Yeah. So then that led me to my first, long-term hold, which was a fourplex in Ildicon. And Ildicon is considered to be a pretty rough area, and I got to where I was owning four fourplexes in there at a certain point, where my nickname over there was the Pasty Gangster. That's what the tenants were calling me. Yeah,
Ildikon, where is that?
Kind of in Scott near Acadiana. Yeah, so from 2010 on, I started holding on to properties, single family homes, as rental properties, and started building
kind of a nest egg of those, flipping them for a lump sum.
I might flip some, but some deals might be a rental. And I just kind of built a portfolio of rentals and transitioned from there to selling off some low income properties to move into some bigger properties. And then it became maybe some apartment complexes or a commercial property. And so kind of falls in line with, you know, my athletic career of, okay, I've made it here. Like, what's next? Like, where do I push myself now? And so my transition in my business career, real estate careers, kind of followed the same thing. Fear of not doing something, like saying, man, I wish I would have tried to do that, and constantly trying to get better at something or find the next challenge. And I think that's kind of how my business career grew, is from always wanting to challenge myself to the next thing. Even to this day, there's some projects that I'm doing that I would have never thought a kid from Lachute, Quebec would have built this or done this or put up like a, not like a landmark, but a piece of real estate that's going to be there well after I'm gone.
Right, right.
I just think that's really cool. Like, I never would have thought that I'd have the capabilities of doing these things, but
yeah, you didn't think you'd make the Olympics either.
No, exactly. So I mean, I'm again, it's, I look at, let's say, my journey, almost like that wasn't me, like that was somebody else. But I'm happy to tell the story because, it should be encouraging to someone that is sitting back saying, I'm not happy with my career, or I don't know what I'm going to do next, or a kid in college or a kid in high school or their athletic journey or someone's professional journey. I'm a big proponent of constantly educating yourself, constantly learning, constantly trying to be an expert in your craft. But I'm also a huge proponent of finding what you love doing and sticking with it. That's the ultimate reward to me. Like, I've never done anything. That's not a right statement, saying I've never done anything for money. Like, obviously, I was flipping houses and doing those things because I need the income to pay bills. But ultimately, it. That sounds stupid to say. It's like, it's not about the money. The satisfaction of doing something is more important to me, and doing it right, do it properly, being like morally ethical and working hard at it and grinding through all the crap that comes with it. And then when it's all finished, something that you're proud of, like the financial rewards will come when that's how you operate. And I believe in that. And, I mean, knock on wood, they have. And it, financially, it's been rewarding. But that's not the fulfilling part. The fulfilling part is the journey of a project, of something that didn't exist that wasn't there, or something that nobody else really saw except for me, or it was too hard for other people to try to do, but I did it. And that feels really good.
Yeah. So you think you found what you love to do? Like, this is what you love to do?
Yes, for right now.
Yeah.
I mean, whether that's forever, but I know for right now, it's, every day is not all enjoyment. And
right,
like
there's always tough parts.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of stress.
I mean, even with what I do, you would think, oh, he just plays around on social media, he creates a little podcast, he talks a little bit. There's some hard days, hard weeks.
You said it earlier, which people don't see, but they don't, they don't need to see. The right people need to see. Like you said, you started doing interviews in 2018. Like, that's a huge collection of interviews. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't get a following by doing two podcasts and then you're done. Like, there's a journey to it. Now there's a reputation. Now there's a following. Now it's continuing to build it. Like, if you stopped right now, all the momentum's going to be gone soon enough. So you got to keep grinding through, like, who am I going to interview? What's the technology for it? How do I grow the views? I mean, you know, everybody wants to be a podcaster and everybody wants to be an influencer and all that of, you know, today's generation. But
everybody,
ask 99.9% of successful influencers or podcasters how they started. And none of them will say, oh, I just picked up a microphone and I had a million hits.
Yeah, like, it doesn't happen.
Oh, no, it's a grind.
Yeah.
But 90% of people will believe it's like a lotto ticket, but there's 10% of people out there that need to know what it takes to be successful at what you want to do, because that should at least prepare them for what they're up against.
Yeah.
And if they're willing to take that challenge, like, the reward is there. It's not 6 months later, a year later, 2 years later. It's 3, 4, 5, 6 years later.
Mm-hmm. It takes a while.
Yep.
So I have a friend, and this friend will remain nameless, just as a friend. Hunter Thievis, real quick, I'll continue my thought. Hunter Thievis says, Phil is the man. All right, Hunter, thank you.
All right, Hunter, call my wife. Can you tell her that too, please?
So this friend I have, we've been knowing each other since about 2012-ish, 2013. And it's interesting because I started developing Lafayette in 2012. So my friend has seen what I've been able to start and stick with and grow and ultimately expand into and make it essentially my career at this point. And he's watched my process. And throughout those years, he's started his own little things and then fizzled out. Started something else, fizzled out. Started something else and fizzled out. And every single time that he would express his frustration about not being satisfied and not getting what he thought he would get out of it, I tell him, like, you keep stopping.
Yeah.
If you want to do something, and if it's something that you would like to do, just love to do in general, if money is not the main part, I know that's so cliche to say. And sometimes it's hard to say that because you do want to make a living.
Yeah.
But you also don't want to hate what you do for a living. Right. And some people hate what they do for a living. Like, there are some people that have careers that with high suicide rates.
Yeah.
It's because it pays good. It doesn't fulfill them.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. Just there's some things. But so throughout the years, I've been telling him, like, you know, friend, I was about to say his name, friend, just quit talking about wanting to do it and use the Nike's tagline. Yeah. Just do it.
Yeah.
Just stick with it. It's going to suck sometimes.
Yeah.
There's a suck phase. You're going to have to suck for a while until you get to the good part.
So, and the number one thing is, do you have a high level of confidence that this is what you enjoy doing? Or will you, is this a career path, or is this something that you will enjoy doing? That's number one. Like, if you don't think you'll really enjoy it, well, then stop right there. It's not happening. But if you think you're going to enjoy it, I mean, and I go through, you know, like, sports thoughts or sports analogies or things my coaches have said. And, and there's one that always talked about pumping the pump. Pump the pump. That's what he used to say, which is basically you're at a water well. And when you're pumping the well, you keep pumping. You keep
and
pumping.
And nothing's coming
and
out.
Nothing's happening. And nothing's happening. And actually, the story is he'd tell a story about a little boy and his family, and the family tell him out to go out and get the water, and he'd pump the pump, and then no water would come out, and he'd go back in and say, you know, man, there was no water, okay, try again tomorrow. Well, he'd try back, pump the pump, nothing would happen, and then next thing you know, his whole family died. And little did he know that he was one pump away from the water spilling out. And once the water starts spilling out, it's so much easier. Now you've primed it. Now you just got to go one pump and it's there. So you just got to get to that moment. As soon as you let it go, all that priming, all that effort is right back down to zero.
Oh, God. You know what's crazy is that right there, that little nugget of don't let it go is something that I personally need to hear because things get tough.
Yeah.
There are times where you just, you know, you're like, think that, you know, is this the day that I just like decide to quit?
Yeah.
You know, and I'll be honest, there's been many, many times where I thought, I'm done. I'm done with doing this. Not that I hate doing it. I love doing it. But there's stress that comes with it. There's, of course, being such a prominent page in the community and the following that we've been able to build up. There's people that say things. There's some things that happen. And, of course, now that, you know, business partners are involved, there's things that happen with that sometimes. And it just really, it's almost like grinding against sandpaper and it hurts. And you just want to get off of that sandpaper belt. Like, let me get off of this ride. And then there's times where you just have to remember that the good times, the fun parts usually outweigh the hard parts, at least for me. And I have to remember that. So that part about don't let it go. Once it's flowing, it flows in as long as you stay with it, because that's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to stick with it sometimes.
Yeah. But success doesn't come easy. Anything fulfilling doesn't come easy. I tell my kids, and I've told other kids just from coaching, usually the right decision is the hardest path to take. You've got two forks on the road. You go left, it's the easy route. And let's just say, let's just we're talking about drugs or vaping or whatever the case is. And your friends are telling you, that, you know, smoke some weed, vape, whatever the case is. The easy decision is to go ahead and do it. They're going to get off your back. You're going to do it. Get Peer it over pressure. With. You're done. The hard decision is, no, I'm not doing it. Pull yourself out of that environment. Get made fun of, whatever the case is. But the right decision is generally the hardest road to take. But it's because on taking that road and making it to the finish line, where that it was, is where the ultimate satisfaction comes. There's no ultimate satisfaction from taking the easy route. It's always from going, taking the more difficult route. That's where the gold is. Like, that's where the fun part is. And not everybody gets that. I mean, there's not a successful person that exists in the world that does not say the same thing you just did.
Mm-hmm.
I say it once every 3 weeks, probably, of just like, I mean, you know, so we're building 77 townhomes right now.
Yeah.
We did phase one, which is 38. I've just put them on the market a couple weeks ago. You know, they're little, it's been slower than I wanted to as far as the response, which is I'll say discouraging, but I'm like so excited about these, what we did, how great they look, how hard we worked at it. And like, here they are, they're for sale. And I'm expecting just like the floodgates to open
and
people coming in, and it's like, oh man, like, why am I doing this? Like, what's the point of doing all that? Or, you know, and you do get those feelings, and but it's like, no, I believe in this. I know this is going to, you know, I know this is going to work. I believe in it. I know the effort that we put in. I know the quality we put in. I know people are going to appreciate it. We just got to get over that hump and get things started.
Yeah.
So, honestly, you know, whether it's once every 3 weeks or so, I'm like, oh man, why do I keep doing this? I might as well just stop, just, you know, collect rent money and, you know, live a comfortable life and all that. But, what's the fun in that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like working out at the gym, and your motivation doesn't come You don't wait for motivation to do something. Motivation comes after you've started having success. You just got to push yourself to get to that hump. Like if I want to lose weight, if I got to sit and wait until I'm motivated to go to the gym, I'm just going to get fatter.
You're just going to get fatter,
If it takes more motivation. If I just get off my ass and just to do it, like even in small chunks and big and build off of that, don't even look at the scale. Like just do that for 2 months.
Yeah.
Then step on the scale. I was like, well, shit, I just lost 5 pounds or 10 pounds. Well, man, now I'm wanting to go to the gym. Like now I'm getting motivated. You know what I mean? So
look, I'm same thing with me. I love the gym analogy because that's so true. And you could apply that analogy with a lot. Like, so starting developing Lafayette, I had 0 followers. And I did not start developing Lafayette thinking, oh, one day I'm going to have, you know, almost 70,000 followers on Facebook, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't like that. I was like, I wanted to show a picture of a construction site because I was excited that this place was coming to Lafayette. Posted it. And just like you, I thought, oh, yeah, you know, there'll be some people that like this. Nobody liked it. It was my first photo. Nobody liked it. 0 followers. I said, you know what? It's all good. I took the photo from me and I shared it. That's all I needed.
Yeah.
And then I saw another construction site. I say, oh, let me take a picture of it, post it. And I think one person liked it. I'm like, cool. Typically, it was just me liking my own photos, giving myself my own artificial boost.
Yeah.
And I'd post another photo and I'd get a couple more likes, and I hate to say that likes feels good, but there, you know, it's almost like I equate it to building that muscle in the gym. Like you see it come through, and like the more you put towards your work and the more you add to it, the better you get at it, the more response you see. Essentially building muscle is a response of the work you put into it. And so I kind of equate it like that. And now, you know, I'm 12, what is it? I started in 2012, so it's 13 years or something like that in it now. And now whenever I post a picture or an article, you know, it's to see a 0 response is not going to happen.
Yeah,
Facebook is broke if it's that. Yeah. But most of the time I get anywhere from 100 to, lately, 100 to 1,000 responses. And people see that and they go, man, you built up this thing. And like how long did it take you? Like they just found out about us. And they're like, huh, like, how did you grow this so fast? I'm like, I started in 2012. When Facebook was still relatively infant, you know, and having a business page was really, really new. And, you know, all that work put into it. So, yeah, it just, yeah.
There's ways to speed up the process. Let's say nothing's ever an overnight success, but a couple of things I usually tell people. One is you're the sum total of the 5 people you hang out with.
Yep.
So if you don't like your results, maybe look at your circle.
Hang out with different people.
And maybe hang out with different people. Hang out with people that are doing the things that you want to do. Learn from them. Like, that's really the only way that you can maybe fast track your journey. And I was fortunate that I had unbelievable mentors, like, coming up. And I mean, you know, of course, Tony Robichaud was
a good
probably
one,
the greatest mentor I've ever had. And, you know, in real estate, I had a mentor, Hammy Davis, who you know, passed away 3 years ago.
Davis is a good guy.
I mean, just heart of gold. And I learned so much from him. And it's so fortunate to have been like under his umbrella to you just learn from him. But you need to surround yourself with mentors to learn, and people that have, you know, that you respect, that have done things that you would consider to be the right way in a field that you want to follow. Generally, the right people or anyone that is successful at what they do, they're successful because they learned from someone else.
Yeah.
And they might be at a period where they want to give back, or they, you know, they're ready to open up to the you know, some young blood or someone else that's up and coming because they see themselves in that person. But, you know, I get asked all the time, like, hey, can we go do lunch or breakfast? I want to get into real estate. I want to do this. And I would love to spend my time with people that want to learn the industry. But I always ask them, like, okay, what books have you read? What podcasts you listen to? You know, and if they're starting, and I'll say, look, read these books, read these two books, or read this one book, or listen to this podcast. And then from that, your direction will start moving to maybe some questions that you'd want to know. Maybe write down those questions, but do that first, and then call me, and then let's visit.
Yeah.
I've had...
You're priming them.
I've had zero return phone calls after that because... I don't want to say they didn't want to put in the work.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
But if I had, you know, if I was asking someone that has experience in a space I want to be in, and they're giving me, like, at least the nugget of read this book or this, like, I would be devouring it. Like, I'd be done in a day because I want to learn.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that in you, you're not going to be successful.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of people want the overnight success. They want the quick... get rich quick kind of thing. And especially since 2020, you've seen a lot of that with like online presence and people creating, you know, Etsy stores. I created my own Etsy store. We're all trying to survive, but, you know, to really thrive in a spot, it doesn't come fast. And, it's interesting that you've never gotten any return phone calls.
Yeah.
The
fun is in the journey,
yeah.
Not the result.
Yeah.
You're not driven by your goal. The goal should not be what you're consumed by. You should be consumed by the process. So everybody should have a goal. Like your goal is to reach 100,000 followers. You know, let's just say it's a million followers. That's your goal. You could put that on your wall and say that's your goal. That's just nice to look at. It's not getting anywhere. What is the game plan? What is the game plan to get 100,000 followers or a million followers? Okay, let me learn. Let me figure that out. Let me learn from someone that's done there. Let me educate myself. Okay, what? Okay, now I know. I got a good idea what the process is. Now you follow the process, and if you believe in that process, you stick with it, and that goal is gonna eventually show up for you. But if you're just thinking about the goal, I mean, let's go back to the gym analogy and you want to lose 20 pounds. Your goal is to lose 20 pounds. Well, that doesn't do anything for you. Nothing. What's the process? All right, I'm going to go to the gym and I'm going to go on the treadmill 20 minutes a day for 5 days. I did this research and it says that if you do that a certain period of time, okay, and then I'm going to watch my calories. I'm going to output more than I input. Okay, what's the stress? Okay,
that's hard to do.
Yeah. Oh, it's very hard to do.
In Louisiana.
It's very hard to do. But if that's your goal,
yep.
That's what you want to get, here's the process. And that's true for everything, anything you want to accomplish. Anybody that's owns a business that is in a profession and they want to get to a certain level, they're looking to do something. The process is the secret sauce, not creating the goal. And if you have mentors, and in fact, I had breakfast a couple of days ago with a great friend of mine. We played baseball together. His name's Rick Heidel. So Rick is involved with, it's a book I read called Traction, which is a great book that helps you structure your business. And through that, there's a system called the EOS system, which is the Entrepreneurial Operations System. So he's piggybacked with this group to teach other business owners about the EOS and just how to structure your business where, okay, we know the goal. What is the process? And he's someone that will help you with that process, creating that process. And I think that's so important.
Yeah.
You cannot have any success or reach a goal without a process. Some people don't know what that process is. And, you know, you got to seek out that information, whether it's from a mentor, whether it's from a business coach, whether it's listening podcasts, reading books. But I'm always reinventing, recreating, experimenting with, perfecting, like the process.
Yeah, the process is going to be ever changing. Like, I don't know anybody who has a process that has not changed in the past 5 to 10 years. You look at fast food, for example, there's a process that there's like the line, the kitchen line.
Right.
there's different processes, and throughout those years, those processes change. There might be a temperature change that needs to be, you know, altered. There's a way to shave off 10 seconds from the line.
AI, technology, all that is you know,
part of the process.
Part of the process. The things that don't change is the core values that are associated with whatever you're doing.
Yep.
And that's one thing that should never change. If you're willing to compromise your core values, then your ultimate reward or goals will be affected by that. You know, the process can change, your core values cannot. And that's something that's like paramount for me is, you know, within my company, the people that we hire have to fit this bucket of type of person. Like, forget skill set, it starts with who they are.
Yeah.
Anybody representing us as a company with Frontline or with, you know, I have a roofing company with a good friend of mine and Grizzly Roofing, and it's the same there too. Like, anybody that comes in that's associated with those companies, they have to fit a certain characteristic of person, period. And maybe we hire them and we figure out that that doesn't fit. Maybe we figure out that, man, they're really good at the work part, but, man, this core value part is just lacking.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry, it's not going to work for us. Like, we're not the right fit. And I'm a firm believer in that too, is you got to plant your flag on your core values, who you are as a person, and you're not going to deviate from that for anything. Not for money, not for, you know, fame, fortune, or anything else. That's what you're living and dying by. This is what I believe. And that's how I try to operate. You know, it's not always easy, but I know when it's the right thing to do, and what is the right thing to do generally, and I got to stick with that. Anytime that I didn't got away from it, I get burnt. And I mean, that's how things should work. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it's, ouch, okay, I just got burnt. Oh, yeah, let me not do that again. Like, I got away from what I thought, you know, I compromised something, and I don't deserve the reward because I succumbed to something to take the easy path. And you know, you shouldn't get rewarded for that. So
there's some core values that I set for myself whenever I started developing Lafayette. And I try my best to stick with those. I don't want to say they're loose core values, but they are contingent on certain parameters. And I have other core values too that are obviously solid. But like as far as like the company is like what I put out there as far as content, I have certain qualifications that I say what I would like to put on. Because basically what I'm doing is feeding people information.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be known as that page that's feeding people information that they can't utilize or if they can't find enjoyment out of or see growth in Lafayette. If that piece of content doesn't do that, I try not to show that unless it's, for example, I'll just go ahead and tell you this. So in the beginning, I told myself, because I was just by myself, that I would not write or post about smoke shops or strip clubs because I'm a Christian guy. Not to say smoke shops are not Christian. Don't get that twisted. Now, strip clubs, you use your own assumption there.
So I can't tell you about a strip club I'm about to open.
Oh, so let me tell you the contingency part.
I'm just kidding. Okay,
good. But the contingency part is if that company, whether it be a smoke shop, vape shop, whatever it is, or that strip club is building a structure that's brand new from the ground up and the majority of the following is hungry enough to know what that is being built.
Yeah.
Then I feel obligated to let them know what's being built.
Yeah.
That's why I started the page.
Yeah.
What's being built right there.
Yeah.
So if it's a standalone spot, brand new construction, I will write about that company.
Yeah.
And I will be as gist about it as I can. For example, Michael's Men's Club.
Yeah.
Okay, we're all familiar with Michael's Men's Club, right? Some of you guys. I've never been there.
Where
but
is
I,
that?
It's, look, I just know it's in Broussard. Right. That's all I know. But the sign says fine food, fine women, or something like that. I've never been there. Trust me. Believe that. But anyway, they started a construction project. And at first I was like, oh, okay, cool. They're expanding Michael's Men's Clubs. They're doing some work. What was fascinating was how they were expanding. Typically, I would not have written about it, but because of the way that they were doing it was mind-blowing. I'm like, they are literally milking every moment of zero downtime they can. Like, so
I think I know what you're talking about, because I thought it looked like they built around their existing structure.
They built a metal structure around their existing in operation structure. Yeah. And I guess, you know, did the facade and everything. And I guess at the last moment that they could possibly wait, demo the other portion and build out the other side. Because, like, I don't know, I guess it would have been weird if they would have, like, had a demo of it and people would have been like, oh, my God, people, you know, they demoed Michael's. What are we going to do now type thing? I don't know that would have been like. But
no, what have you done? What would you have been doing then? That's what you're asking yourself, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
Boy, what a big reveal right here on this podcast.
But, you know, I just thought it was a cool thing that they did. Not to promote the strip club, but the fact that the ingenuity behind how they were renovating. Yeah. And I was like, okay, I will write about it. But I was very cautious on how I wrote about it. I was very short. I said, look, here's some photos. Take this for what you want.
Well, another good example. Another good example of that is because you've said it before, and I know you make a point of it, which is to the values. Like, you generally don't put anything out that you haven't really vetted to know, like, this is happening. And in fact, I think I
try my best.
And we talked about that, which I'll give you some breaking news. So we had talked about that on the Denny's deal on Ambassador, where the lease hadn't been signed yet. You know, so and you'd say, like, okay, let's wait until it's, like, you know, there's a contract now.
Yeah, I like to see tangibles.
Yeah, we had talked about it, but you weren't going to put it out on Developing Lafayette unless you knew that it was happening. Yeah. So, but
now, 'cause I've been burned a few times of trying to be early.
Yeah.
And was like, okay, this project never happened. What am I going to do now?
Yeah.
But people are now still asking me about certain projects happened.
But you could have put it out just to get the views, get the interest, get the engagement, but you chose not to. So, like, but breaking news, Denny's is not coming anymore. So that deal has gone south. And but when I said the 3 weeks, every 3 weeks where I have like that moment of, man, what am I doing?
I bet that was one.
Yeah. Like, I put out a big commitment to a project, and of course you got to, the more tenants you have in the deal, the less the risk is. Well, I don't want to get into the as to the why.
Wow.
But sometimes things happen for a reason.
Yeah.
I'm negotiating through a letter of intent for someone else to come in that space, which for me is even better than Denny's. It's a better fit. I think I think it's a better tenant, better graded tenant. I think if it does work out, I think a lot of people will be equally and more excited. I'm more excited about it if it does work out. But no Denny's on Ambassador.
Okay.
So I had to redo some advertising, pulling their logo out of it. In fact, if you drive by the space, you'll see we have the monument signs up with the Jet Coffee and Jersey Mike's, and we have Mimi's Nails, and we just signed another letter of intent with a tenant that I'll let you know about so you can announce. There's no Denny sign up there.
Man.
Yeah, they had put a Denny sign up, and before they put it up, I said no. I said you can't put that up. You got to take that down. Like, I don't want to mislead anybody.
Right.
But, I'm telling everybody Denny's is coming. I mean, but I lease is signed. So it was seemingly a done deal. Well, when a lease is signed, it is a done deal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, now we're going in a different direction.
Oh, God.
But
okay.
But yeah.
This is just
breaking news. There you go. I wasn't planning on telling you that while we were sitting here, but I told you I didn't want you to tell me what you were going to talk about, the questions you're going to ask. I'm just going to show up and I'm going to sit here and we'll just have a conversation. So there you go.
Look, I really appreciate it, because let me tell you, I've had a lot of people been asking me, what's happening with Denny's? When is it opening? And I've been giving them, it looks like maybe another 2 to 3 months.
Yeah.
Because I really don't know.
Yeah, that's what I said. I mean, the building's done. I was ready to turn over the keys to start for them to start their tenant.
Is the interior done too?
No, it's just a blank shell. Man. Yeah. But that's the time where the tenant comes in and starts doing their build out, and they just never showed up. So,
well, I'm excited to hear what
breaking news.
I'm excited to hear what the other tenant would be.
Hopefully we can work that out. Yeah. And if we can't, someone else is going to come along. It's just, okay, now I got to go. I pumped the pump.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
things work themselves out sometimes. It was discouraging, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, no, I love the way the direction of the conversation went to priming that letdown, you know? But that means that there's something potentially better on the way.
Correct.
So there's that. Phil, we are at an hour and 20 minutes.
Ooh.
I know.
What's the record? Let's keep going.
Dude.
I'm just kidding.
It's close to 2 hours. So we're not that far away, but...
All right.
And so we did have one more comment that came through in our conversation. It's Tad Quibido. He is the general manager at Jersey Mike's.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Yep. So Jersey Mike's opened on Johnson, and they're opening soon in the development that you are a part of. So... that's really cool. He's a great guy. And he said, Phil rocks.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. I think I'm looking forward to them opening. I think coming up soon. I think right beginning of April, from what I understand.
Yep. Beginning of April. I want to say it was April 1st, which I think any business that opens up on April 1st, like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like you're messing with stuff.
Yeah. P.F. Chang's opening also on April 1st.
Always.
Yeah.
P.F. Chang's is always opening in Lafayette on April 1st. Well, man, I think that is all I have. Phil, is there anything else that we didn't talk about that you want to mention before we go?
I don't want to break the record, so I think we're all good. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, man, I appreciate all the good conversation that we had. I know there's probably some things that I skipped over, because that's just how conversations roll. But speaking of AI earlier, I do use AI to help me with my research. So I went and scrubbed tons of stuff, like the Wikipedia, some articles, and I just plugged them in and said, give me a summary and break down some bullet points.
Really?
And it gave me some really cool stuff, and it helped me out. I still have a bunch of other notes, but like I said, conversations lead one way, and I wanted to make sure to work in the earlier career for you in baseball, and then also cover the professional with the development and the businesses that you're a part of. I think that was great content. And thank you for coming on.
Yeah, awesome. Good. Thanks for having me.
Well, guys, that is it. You can find the episode on our website. Hopefully, after this weekend, we'll upload it. And it's already live on Facebook and on YouTube. So if you want to watch the video of it, it's there. But the audio version will be uploaded at a later date. But anyway, with that, we'll let you guys go. Phil, have a great weekend. And I look forward to hearing what's coming in the space.
Sounds good.
All right, that's it, guys. Y'all have a great one.